This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
The famous line, the comfortable concentration, the home is a comfortable concentration camp. What was it, Ar-Rahman, in the poem? Amilatun fi sijni hal maqiti. It's been translated. It's very, you know, that she is a, you know, prisoner in her house. By the way, she actually retracted this, very interesting, in her book called Second Stage, which she wrote some 10 years after or something like this. She said this was a bit extreme for me to say that. People don't realize she made a hell of a lot of retractions. Why did she make retractions? I'll tell you why she made retractions. She made retractions because in the year 1970, she wrote a book called The Second Stage. You can get this book. And she realized by doing these kind of sociological investigations that women were actually having things worse. That things were getting worse for women. I'm going to read something from her book right now. She said that women are experiencing more signs of psychological stress than women in their 20s and 30s had in the 50s and early 60s, she admits. Listen to what she says. And were more likely to feel on edge of a nervous breakdown than young men, she said. So this is after what? After the Civil Rights Movement, after the implementation of Equal Rights Act, after women are going to work, after all of the discussion about feminism, after women were burning bras, after. So she goes and checks to see if women are happy now because of what she's done. And she realized actually women are sadder, they're worse off. Their welfare has been affected in the negative. And she says that she admits this in her book, The Second Stage, which, by the way, you don't find in curricula. You don't find in syllabi, this book, Second Stage. You find Feminine Mystique. Even in GCSE and A-levels, they don't teach any kids about The Second Stage. It's a book she wrote. And in fact, it's a book she wrote after the book, Feminine Mystique. But because it has all these admissions, these dirty admissions that she puts and she tells us the truth about, we want to hide this under the carpet, do we? Women 35 to 39, one in three, she says in the same book, in the 1970s experienced a nervous breakdown, which is more than a 10% increase, which is in sociological terms quite heavy. So she realized, based on her own study, this is Betty Friedan we're talking about, that more women were suffering after the implementation of all of these things, and after they go into work, and after they've taken up all these attitudes towards domesticity, and the family, and the home, and the motherhood, and all these things, you see. And she even admits, quite interestingly in the book, she goes, women have a profound human impulse to have children. Well, you weren't saying that before. All the tone has changed now, has it? When you see women are suffering and coming to you and crying in nervous breakdowns, now you're saying, well, actually women have a profound instinct, she says, or impulse, sorry, to have children. Well, you weren't saying that before, Friedan. She realizes what she put women in. But is she the only one? You'll be surprised, she's not the only one. In 1981, after realizing the troubling psychological impact of women, Friedan states this. Let me just go with Friedan for a second. She says, we had better find a change. But change is hard, because listen to what she says. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable what she says. Listen to this. She goes, because women have almost a religious feeling about the women's movement. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Subhanallah. She says, we've got to change this now. This is 20 years after everything. She goes, because women now are becoming, it's like feminism has become religion. Who's saying that? Betty Friedan, one of the founding mothers of feminism. She goes, I realize we have to make a change. She's saying this. I realize we have to make a change, but what? But it's difficult now because women have a what? A religious feeling towards feminism. Can you imagine this? A sacredness, a reverence, an awe. This is what she continues. It keeps us from asking questions about what really matters to women now. So, you see, it's really negatively impacted women. She realizes that. She wants to change that, but she can't because she's already created a monster. She's already created the Frankenstein of feminism. She's already helped contribute to that. And now she's trying to pull women back. Actually, we're going too far. No, it's too far. The Frankenstein has already been created. And do you know who's suffering for it? Women are suffering more because of it. And what one of the most powerful things I've ever read from a feminist is from Germaine Greer in her book, 1981, The Whole Woman. Remember, Germaine Greer was one of the founding mothers of feminism. See her online. How she's coming with arrogance and talking and smoking cigarette and this and that. And she's with confidence talking about how important it is and attacking domesticity, attacking this inequality and all that kind of. And then what? She comes in 1981, she goes, I mourn for my unborn babies. I mourn for my unborn babies, she says. This is two of your big names. Two already. We're going to come to the third one, which is the worst one, by the way. Which she said, I mourn for my unborn babies, she said. She goes, I still have pregnancy dreams. She's exposing herself, waiting with vast joy, something that will never happen. Because she's over, she's past the age of pregnancy. Never happen. Allahu Akbar. It's a punishment for you. Because you were telling all the women. You're telling all the women that motherhood is X, Y, Z and all that. Now you'll be punished because you realize that actually you suppressed your instinct and you hurt yourself. You only hurt you. You're playing with fire. You played with fire and you got burnt. De Beauvoir, who is the one, yani, if you want to put the main woman of feminism in the second wave is De Beauvoir, the second sex, because it had been probably the most robust and thorough philosophical work that had been done on feminism. And up until the third wave, it was the main way in which scholars of feminism would argue for feminism. Okay, this is what she says. We know her thought, right? She attacks the institution of motherhood. She attacks domesticity. She talks about, you know, how it's oppressive to be a man, and biologically even, and these things. But she says the following. She goes, she was talking about, she had a boyfriend. His name was Sartre, Jean Paul Sartre, a huge philosopher, big name. Imagine now, she's telling women not to have what? Husbands or this. She's telling them not to have husbands, yeah? Not to be married, not to have kids. But listen to what she says about her own boyfriend. Listen to what she said. She goes, I felt dominated by someone else intellectually. Sartre lived up to the man I had dreamt up until 15. I was simply not in his class. Wallahi, I have not seen one single Muslim woman to ever say that. With the most complementarian lifestyle. She's an egalitarian. She said, I've never heard anything. I was dominated by my husband. I was not even in his class. The most traditionalist woman, the Amish. I've never said, this is what? So you're telling women not to have kids. You're telling women not to. She's like the devil. Wallahi, she is like shaitan. Sorry, let me just go into religious discourse for that. مثله كمثل الشيطان إذ قال للإنسان اكفر فلما كفر قال أنا بريء منك. It's like this in the Quran, it says, it's like him, it's like the devil. He says, go and do disbelief. And when he does it, he says, I have got nothing to do with you. In her own life, what's she doing? She's saying, you're my superior. I'm not even in your class. But she's writing in her books as well. She's writing, don't get married, don't have children, don't allow this from the man. It's like this nonsense hypocrite. She's a nonsense hypocrite.
That's why there's a statement, you're a feminist until you get married.
Well, she wasn't even married. We'll come on to it. She wishes she was. As she even admits, well, not this, but she goes, I was simply not in his class. She looked in the mirror. Just like you, Ali Dawah, she said something that you said. She said, I detest my own reflection. She goes, if at least my own thought had given birth to a hill, a rocket, but nothing has taken place. I'm astonished to realize how thoroughly I have been cheated. Cheated by who? Who are you talking about? Cheated by yourself. You cheated yourself. Yeah? She's writing her autobiography. She thought we didn't read. Then she also admits, she thinks it's a diary entry. She writes the following, she goes, before her boyfriend, Sartre, came from Paris, she goes, she was preparing her new independent home in Paris and waiting for the return of Sartre from Paris. New furniture is brought, the walls are papered, and new clothes are purchased. Oh, you're trying to make an effort for him, are you? You're trying to make an effort for him, are you? But you tell the woman to what? Not to get married. But you wish you were married. You wish you had that commitment. He called her, one time he said to her, because you know, she came back home, she wasn't there. She said, you're like a mere housewife. Obviously, in their understanding, this is a huge embarrassment. She says, I was furious with myself to have disappointed him in this way. And you know, he's the one, by the way, if you look at her autobiography, who persuaded her. He's the one who persuaded her to write The Second Sex. So we have a valid question here. Was second wave feminism created by Sartre, by a man? Was he the one doing all the work? Was he the one pushing her to do these things? Why? Because it's in the benefit, we're going to come to realize, it's in the benefit of the man. It is. This is what women don't understand. Please, some women do, of course, but some women don't. Feminist women. That feminism, second wave, benefits the man psychologically, as we'll find, more than it benefits the woman. He doesn't need to commit. He doesn't need to have kids. He doesn't need to do all those things. He can move from one woman to another. Use and abuse. Lash and dash, he can. This is the situation. But let's not mention that. What we should mention is some sociological investigations. And the biggest one that's ever been done, that I know of, is this one that is mentioned. It's mentioned in the poem as well. Do you remember what the lines were? Yeah, this is the Dirasa al-Gharbiya that's been through. Fi mi'at elf, yeah? This is the mi'at elf. It's Blanche Flower and Oswald. This is the name of the study, 2000, okay? 100,000 participants, it's a longitudinal study from the years 1970 to the years 1990 in the UK and the US. Huge study, very difficult to replicate. And this is what the researchers said, that men are happier and women are sadder. In the time period after the feminist movement has taken its force, and after all the laws have been placed, and after the attitudes have changed, and after women are going to work, why are they happier and sadder? Well, because let me tell you why. Because they say legislative reform and so on has not been successful in either country, in creating or raising the well-being among women. The quote is messed up a little bit on the slides. But that's, you see, this big thing is saying what? In fact, the same study said, do you know who was getting happier? Men were getting happier. They're getting what they want. The commitment issues have gone down. He doesn't have to extract his resources for her. He's got more money now. He can just use her, move from woman to woman. She's the one, she wants security. She's the one psychologically primed for these things. You want to play this game with a man and you think you're going to be happier? You don't know what you're doing. You've created 20 years longitudinal study. It tells us that in fact the welfare of women has degenerated considerably or exponentially as a result of what? As a result, or after at least, these policies had been implemented. Now, why is this the case, or what should we think about? I mean, feminists know, even a second word feminist, that there are differences, considerable physiological and psychological and even biological, as we know, differences between men and women. But basically, their argument is, despite all of these differences, that we should be treated the same. Now, the burden of proof is upon the one who's making the claim. Why do we need to be on the back foot? If someone asks you, why is it different for whatever ruling it is in Islam or whatever other system even, that differentiates between ruling a man and woman, so why is it different? Why should it be the same, in fact? Plato, he made a very interesting Aristotle quotes him. He says, treat like cases as like, meaning identical things should be treated identically. And different things, by extension, should be treated what? Differently. Now, your feminism doesn't accommodate for the differences between men and women. That's a failure. That means it has less explanatory scope. Now, why should we cover for their failure or even accept it as a presupposition for answering their questions? They're asking, why is it that, we'll come to it, but why is the inheritance difference? Why is polygamy? Why is man can marry this and that? Why should it be the same, in fact? Why is there an assumption of equality, of absolute equality? This assumption itself is unsubstantiated. And in fact, they need to argue it from first principles. They need to argue why it should be different things should be treated the same. They need to argue that, not us. And in fact, this is one of the key reasons, and very important here, why ridda happens, why apostasy happens, or why shak happens, or why raib happens in a deen, or doubt. And because we've been in the back foot for too long, have not been able to answer this properly. The way we answer it is the assumption that different things should be treated the same. We believe that identicality in value does not mean, so equality in value does not mean identicality in roles. One more time. Equality of value. We do believe men and women are equal in value. Yeah, in spiritual value, they are equal. Equality of value is not equivalent to identicality in roles. This is an extremely important sentence. Memorize it. If they want to tell us that it should be the case, they have to argue for it. It's not me that has to argue for it. But you know what? Sometimes it's quite easy and it's quite straightforward if we point to them the differences between men and women. Because some of them are actually ignorant of it, even though the feminist founding fathers were not ignorant of it. In the chapter biology, de Beauvoir, she goes, women are weaker than men. She will lose to them in the fight. She has less control of herself. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the idea. She says all this thing. But sometimes you have to show them that is a fact. Let's give some examples of that.